Hey, crew, thanks for listening to Emrecast. Just a heads up that the episode you're about to listen to on pressers and vents is actually divided into two parts. Today, you're going to listen to vasopressors. If you enjoy that episode, stay tuned for the follow-up on managing the ventilator in the ED. We hope you enjoy it. Welcome to this episode of Emrecast, the podcast by residents for residents. I'm your host, Jesse Werner, a PGY3 at Brown. Today, we're incredibly lucky to be speaking with Dr. Haney Malamat, a critical care expert and associate professor of emergency medicine at Cooper Medical School. You may know him by his Twitter presence, at Critical Care Now. Dr. Malamat is triple boarded in internal medicine, emergency medicine, and critical care medicine. Today, he's talking to us about vasopressors and managing the ventilator in the ED. Dr. Malamat, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
You have a conference that you are hosting in Puerto Rico. Is that true?
That is correct. It is called Puerto Rico Fest, ironically enough.
I love it.
It's a critical care ultrasound resuscitation conference that we've been actually running for a few years now. We've been doing it in Mexico, but this year we're doing it in Puerto Rico to help the local economy and some of the docs down there. And I mean, we just got some big name speakers, Amal Matu, Evie Marcolini, Salim Raze. So just some big names. And it's really good short format lectures and hands-on workshops. So if anyone out there wants to come on by, check out the website. It's www.puertoricofest2019.com.
That sounds great. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
All right, let's get right down to it. This is a short segment, so I want to focus on high yield pearls. When I think of these topics, I have to be totally honest with you. I get very anxious. I get sweaty. I get hot. My heart starts beating. I just feel like it's not something I'm super comfortable with. And I imagine being that intern up in the MICU, spending my overnight trying to manage super sick patients or working a really busy critical care shift in the emergency department and that crashing patient rolls in. They need to be quickly stabilized. You know, I intubate them. I think they're septic. And now I'm like trying to find good vent settings. I'm trying to choose pressors. It's all very anxiety provoking. What is some constructive advice for residents who feel similarly?
Well, you and I have something in common. I also get hot and sweaty and my heart pounds because I love critical care. And so I get excited when these patients come in too. And so all we have to do today is just bridge that gap to make it less anxiety provoking for you.
Great.
Now here's the thing. You know what to do. You've been trained how to do this. The difference is that when the critically ill patient comes in, it seems like there's a lot of things happening all at once. And what you have to do is just go back to the roots of your training and kind of the ABCs. And so when you have that patient in front of you, you have to start dissecting down what the problem is. You need to separate out the noise from people yelling and the chaos that's coming with the patient and try to isolate the patient, figure out what's going on. Because if you think about the toughest resuscitation that you have, once you got the environment under control, you knew what to do. But the biggest thing about critical care and resuscitation is just getting that isolation and trying to figure out what exactly is the patient dealing with and then getting right at that problem.
So what are some really clear tips you have for people in order to get control of the room or get control of the situation?
Yeah. So if I have the privilege of knowing that a patient is coming in to me, I have the EMS notification, I know someone sick is coming, this is a good time to pull my team aside and assign roles and rally everyone together. Okay. So who's going to be the team leader? And someone has to be the team leader. This is not like, the two residents will handle it. There's only one captain on the ship. So decide that early on and then start delegating who's going to do what. Who's doing the IV? What side are they going to be on? Who's doing the vital signs? Who's the charge nurse? Who's going to be doing chest compressions if chest compressions are needed? Who's doing the airway? You have to be super granular about this stuff. So when that patient comes in, there's no confusion. Because if you don't, you know what happens. This patient comes in and everyone's trying to do everything all at once. And people are tripping all over themselves, creating a lot of noise and creating a lot of chaos. And that's what adds to our anxiety. So that's if I have the luxury of knowing. If I don't have the luxury of knowing what's coming in and the patient just rolls in, because that's our world, right?
Yes.
Then what I do is I immediately assign tasks to people. I will assume the leadership role and I will say, okay, I'm in charge of this code and I want you to do this, you do that, you do that. And then during the code or during the resuscitation, you have to check in on people. And if people start to deviate from that, make noise or start to get loud, or you need to put people back on task, hey, you know, if you know the person's name, address them by name. If you don't know them by name, you know, blue scrubs, I need you to keep it down a little bit. You're escalating the situation. Now, you might feel like a little bit of a jerk and bossy. We've all felt that way. But you'll find that after a code, people will thank you for that because most codes are not run that way. And when you bring a streamlined approach and less confusion to the situation, people are ultimately grateful for it.
That makes a lot of sense. When we're choosing pressers, we do tend to go with Levofed or Norepi as our first choice. And those are the sepsis guidelines, and it's pretty well accepted that that's what we choose first. After that, it does get a little more confusing. Do you tend to add vasopressin next, followed by epi, or do you go straight to epi?
I tend to add vasopressin, but before we go there, we probably should take a step back and talk about hemodynamics in general. And believe me, I'll keep it very simple because I believe critical care should be very simple. When you have somebody who's hypotensive and you look at the blood pressure, it's low, or you think they're in shock, it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to say, well, we need to get the blood pressure up. But don't forget that perfusion is three things. It's not just blood pressure. So we have the tank that we're trying to fill up. Okay, so that's giving preload, pre-volume. We have the pump, which is the cardiac output. And then we have the pipes. We have our systemic vascular resistance. And any one of those three things or multiples of them can cause hypotension and cause decreased perfusion. So if I have a patient coming in and they're hypotensive, yeah, sure, the first knee-jerk reaction would be to give them fluid. Filling up the pump, filling up the tank first is the most logical step. But you got to get the ultrasound on there and see what the physiology is doing. Because if you're just adding vasopressors here and there and not doing anything, you really don't know. Suppose I told you that you gave 30 cc's per kg and you didn't put the ultrasound on. And then I come down as the consultant for the ICU. I do the ultrasound and that person's EF is 5%. Is it possible that that person has septic shock and a cardiomyopathy on top of that, a septic induced cardiomyopathy? We see it all the time. And so the point is that what my next vasopressor is going to be based on what I see on the ultrasound. And so for a person that I just described with the 5% EF, I might go to epinephrine next because I need a little inotropy, right? Vasopressor will help me with my blood pressure, but what that person really needs is a lot of squeeze. So I fill the tank if they need it, and then I go and look at the pump and see what they need. And so I pick my vasopressor based on that. But if you're just talking about the standard septic patient where you fill up their tank, you give them lots of volume, their pump looks okay, then I'll go norepinephrine first and then I'll go to vasopressin next.
This is such a good point that you really need to tailor your drugs based on what it is that you're treating. And I know in the ED it can be hard when that person's undifferentiated, but I love your point about using ultrasound. So let's talk just briefly about that. The person's sick. You don't have a lot of time. You grab your ultrasound machine. You're going to use your cardiac probe. Are you going to go subxiphoid? Are you going to go straight for the parasternal long or short? What do you like?
So there's multiple protocols that have been out there. Everyone's trying to do their own protocol, get their name so that they can be legendary in medicine. I like the HIMAP protocol. I just think that that's a systematic way where you're not going to miss anything. And to answer your question, with the H is the first part. It's for heart. And what view do I use? I like to go through all three views, or all four views, I should say. The parasternal long axis, the parasternal short axis, the apical, and the subxiphoid. And the reason why I like to go through all four of those is for two reasons. The first reason is that not every patient is going to have every window, and every window gives you something slightly different. The second reason is a more practical one, is that if you only practice one view over and over again, then you're going to find that patient that doesn't have that view, and you're going to be sucky at the view that they do have. So I really encourage people to go through all four views. We time our residents, and once you get going five or six exams, you get very, very fast at it. Now, I'm not saying that you sit there and scrutinize the parasternal longus for like half an hour. You give it a try. They have bend windows, move on. But I like to go through all four of those views every single time. Parasternal long, parasternal short, apical, then subxiphoid.
And remind us again what the HIMAP stands for.
Sure. So the neat thing about the mnemonic is it kind of reminds you what your goal with resuscitation is, right? To improve the mean arterial pressure. But H stands for heart. So you want to evaluate the heart. I is going to be for IVC. I use it for intravascular volume to remind me to do passive leg raises and all that stuff. That's my modification. M is to remind you to look at Morrison's pouch and do a full fast exam view. A is to look at the aorta, and P is called pulmonary to look for pneumothorax, pleural effusions, and any pneumonias. And if you do that systematically, you can essentially rule out or rule in most causes of shock, and you can probably get down to two or three causes if you can't get the single isolated cause. Because by looking at the heart, you're going to rule out obstructive causes like tamponade. You're going to rule out RV failure. You're going to rule out massive MI. There's so many things you could do just doing this systematically. And so we do this every single time a patient comes in sick, almost while they're getting that first liter of crystalloids.
Can we talk about dopamine and dobutamine? This is something that I get tripped up on. And I think you made the excellent point that we need to tailor our pressors based on what it is that we're treating. When dopamine, when dobutamine?
That's a good question. I think dopamine is probably losing all indications. Dopamine is a vasopressor. And the only indication that I can find and experts say is when you have somebody who's hypotensive and bradycardic. Because dopamine has arrhythmogenic potential. It can cause tachycardias. So if you have somebody who is maybe took their metoprolol when they were septic that morning, and now they come in and their heart rate's 60, and you know their heart rate needs to be higher, but they beta blockade themselves, maybe that would be an indication for dopamine. Dobutamine, on the other hand, it's an inotrope. And so if I go to a patient who has a heart that's kind of not beating very well, then I might more apt to start them on dobutamine because I know I need to kickstart that pump and get that stroke volume up. So that's how we distinguish between the two drugs. And again, it goes back to asking the question for that patient who's undifferentiated, is it a problem of the pump? Is it a problem of the pipe? Or is it a problem of the tank? And then once you identify what the problem is, that's where you're going to direct most of your therapy towards.
Okay. And so dobutamine, just to kind of recap, dobutamine is better for maybe our heart failure patient who has a reduced EF.
Correct. Yeah. LV failure. It can also be for RV failure. The thing you have to be careful with dobutamine is that it also can create arrhythmias as well. So there are other inotropes that you can use, but dobutamine is the prototypical one that people like to go to.
Okay. And then dopamine falling out of favor, but better for patients who might have some bradycardia and hypotension. And perhaps that's related to the fact that they're on a beta blocker.
That's one of the reasons why we have other people that are just, they don't mount a response to tachycardia, or you think they just need to get a little bit more heart rate and their blood pressure would be better, right? Because stroke volume is, or cardiac output is stroke volume times heart rate. And so you can have a good stroke volume and a crummy heart rate, and that's why your cardiac output is down.
Perfect. Thank you so much. When should we be thinking about adding another pressor, a second pressor, a third agent, etc.?
Yeah, that's kind of expert opinion, which means ask 10 people something and you'll get 15 different answers. So I don't have a good answer for you. I can only tell you what I do in my practice for what that's worth. And if I have somebody who I think is truly vasodilated or vasoplegic, someone with really bad sepsis, and I get them to about, 15 or 20 of norepinephrine, I'll add on vasopressin. The reason why I'll add it on a little bit earlier, maybe than others, is because there's some evidence that shows that certain patient populations, maybe even the elderly, they respond better to vasopressin. Their vasopressin deplete because of their age, and adding vasopressin in, they get better. And I've seen it many times where the person's on 30 of Levo and the nurse calls me over and says, we should add a second pressor. I'm like, go ahead and start the vaso. And before you know it, that Levofed is right down to 10 because that person was very vasopressin responsive. And the thing is this. Every patient that you see is their own little experiment. No one falls into any categories, and so you can't do broad strokes on these patients. And I always tell the nurses, and I tell the residents, and I tell the fellows, just go ahead and experiment. A bag of vasopressor costs a couple bucks, and you never know how that person's going to respond. So I'd rather start the vasopressin and see that they would respond. And if they don't respond, I've really wasted no money. We can find something else to treat them with.
And the dosing there is 0.04?
It's gone down to 0.03 now. We'll leave it at that. Some people will titrate up, but 0.03 is now the dose that we use as a secondary agent. You just kind of set it and forget it.
All right. And then how long do you wait before you decide that maybe that's not working either and you need something else?
You'll know. You'll know in the first 10 to 15 minutes if their blood pressure is better. And along with all the other signs we look for with better perfusion, good urine output, mental status, climbing skin, all that stuff. But you'll know relatively soon what's happening.
And then your third agent would be sort of dependent on what it is you think you're treating.
Yeah. If I have somebody who is, let's go and just say that they're strictly septic shock. So their heart is pumping okay, so it's not a pump problem. You filled up the tank, it's not a tank problem. And now it's just a vasoplegia problem. So you have them on high dose of norepinephrine and vasopressin. What's the next thing to do? I think epinephrine is a nice drug to go to next.
How high do you go on your epi before you decide that you need yet another agent?
Yeah, so epinephrine is one of those, it's an interesting drug. At doses of 0.01 to 0.05 milligrams per kilogram, and I apologize to the listeners, I don't mean to make you do math while you're listening to this, but 0.01 to 0.05 mics per kilogram per minute, that tends to be the ionotropic dose. So you're really getting more of a squeeze on the heart more than peripheral pressure. Once you cross that threshold, you increasingly get more vasopressor effect. So it really depends on what I'm dealing with. If I have somebody who I'm trying to give them vasopressor and trying to squeeze their heart, I'll go with low dose epi and I'll go with more vasopressor. If I have somebody who they're all vasoplegic, they're getting norepinephrine, they're getting the vasopressor, and they're getting the epi, but they're starting the epi at doses beyond the 0.05 mics per kilo. Now, everyone always asks, what's the maximum dose that you give? And I don't have an answer for you for that. We don't know what the answer is for that. There's things in books that say that that's the max dose, but you can go as high as you want. The thing you have to realize is every time you have a vasopressor on a patient, you're causing organ ischemia, specifically the gut. So again, every patient is different. I've had patients on very high dose pressors whose gut was intact. I've had patients on very small doses, and they've surprised me that they get mesenteric ischemia.
Is there a specific length of time a peripheral pressor can be used? I was always taught that, you know, least amount of time possible, and you want to get the central line in. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, in 2018, what we know is that peripheral vasopressors are safe. There's been a few trials that have shown that. There's ICUs, which I won't call out on the podcast, but there are ICUs that exclusively use vasopressors peripherally. They are central lineless ICU as much as they can be. So the data shows us that it's safe to use for 24, 48, some studies even 72 hours. And that's just when they stop the studies. But let me tell you the practical thing. It's not a matter of hours of how it's safe to give vasopressors. What's most important is that someone is monitoring the line. So if you look at any study that's looked at peripheral vasopressors, you always have a nurse that's checking every 1 to 2 hours at the site to make sure that there's no extravasation. Because if you think about it, that's the biggest harm that there is. You don't want that vasopressor to extravasate into the tissue space and cause necrosis and ischemia. But as long as you have someone checking on that line to make sure that that's not extravasating, theoretically, and I'm not suggesting that people do this, but theoretically, you can use that vasopressor forever.
All right, let's talk resuscitation. The traditional teaching is 30 cc's per kg, then pressors. However, recently, there's been some talk about going straight to pressors and using less fluid for your resuscitation. What should we be doing?
Well, you're too young to remember this, but when I was a resident, what we used to do was we used to give fluids. And then there would be a point where just like, I guess we'll start them on vasopressors. And the thing was, is that we knew we had to put in central line for vasopressors. So nowadays, our thinking has changed. Hypotension, we can all agree, is never a good thing. So if I have a patient that comes in hypotensive, the longer I keep that patient hypotensive, the more risk of injury to those organs internally I'm creating. So now my approach to resuscitation is I have a patient that comes in hypotensive. Sure, give them a liter right off the bat while everything's settling in. But my next move is to start them on vasopressors peripherally and get their blood pressure normalized. Because once I have them normalized, I can still give them more fluid. I haven't precluded the fluid resuscitation, but I've made them normal now. I've minimized the distal hypoperfusion. I've minimized the organ injury. I've minimized all that ischemia that kills people down the road when they go upstairs. And then I can give them fluids. And if I'm lucky, I can resuscitate them off the vasopressors and no more vasopressors. So what I'm trying to say here is that the sooner you eliminate hypotension, the better off your patients are going to be. So that's the strategy we try to employ these days.
So if I have a septic patient coming in and they're hypotensive, how long do you usually wait before you initiate that pressor?
That's always a judgment call. If someone is really hypotensive and they're not responding to fluid, immediately. If the person is kind of borderline and they did bump up with volume, I'll give them another shot with some fluids. How long? No one knows the answer. But I think within an hour, if they're not responding to volume, I definitely would get a central line and start them on vasopressors.
So you would start with fluids and maybe give them about an hour and then move to pressors.
If we're talking about somebody who is kind of borderline hypotensive, if we're talking about someone where I needed to do a central line, then that's kind of a rough estimate. Although I really would be upset with myself every minute that's going by, I'm keeping that person hypotensive. But if I'm working in a shop that can do peripheral vasopressors, they get a liter, No response immediately. And don't forget, we're still looking with the ultrasound because there could be other reasons why this person is hypotensive. We don't want to get anchored into the fact that this is all just a pressure problem.
Love that. Okay, so I'm going to think maybe I'll try a liter and then think about something else. What about stress dose steroids? When, what, how much?
Yeah, so this has been one of those eternal debates in critical care. And I'll tell you, it seems like the data, we've two trials recently that that have really shown that steroids are good for patients with sepsis. So all I can say is yes.
What's your go-to?
Hydrocortisone, just fine. It's easy to dose. And the next question will be that we investigate is whether or not we should do continuous infusion of hydrocortisone, or do we continue with bolus doses that we've been doing every 6 hours. That might be the next question. I don't know if it's really going to be groundbreaking, but the data is really showing that, you know, data from before and data from now, that giving stress dose steroids is helpful for patients in septic shock.
And remind us on the dosing that you give to start off.
You start off with 50 milligrams of hydrocortisone right off the bat. The other question that becomes controversial is the addition of fludrocortisone. Probably not a debate we should get into, although we're not really debating. Fludrocortisone in one of the recent trials has been shown to, as part of the package, reduce mortality. There are other people that say the hydrocortisone has enough mineralocorticoid within it that you don't need to give it. So that might be something that we look at in the future.
All right, I like it. Okay, so today we got some amazing tips from Dr. Haney Malamet, an EMIM critical care physician from Cooper University Hospital. Today we talked about vasopressors. Stay tuned for part two on ventilators. Let's recap, shall we? Perfusion is composed of the tank, preload, the pump, cardiac output, and the pipes, systemic vascular resistance. Hypotension or shock can be caused by any of these, so consider performing ultrasound using the HIMAP protocol. Remember, that's heart, IVC, Morrison's pouch, aorta, and pulmonary. This is a protocol to determine the cause of the hypotension and tailor your resuscitation. Okay, let's go over the pressor algorithm. As long as there's not evidence of a reduced EF or another cause of hypotension, Haney recommends starting with fluids to resuscitate a hypotensive patient. If a patient's critically ill or they're not responding to fluids, consider starting levofed. If the patient's profoundly vasoplegic and levofed's not working, consider adding vasopressin at a dose of 0.03. After that point, you can consider starting epinephrine at a higher dose or greater than 0.05 mics per kg per minute to get the most vasopressive effect. There's no known maximum dosing, but organ ischemia, particularly gut ischemia, can occur, so beware. Consider using dopamine if a patient's bradycardic and hypotensive, for example, if they're beta-blocked. If a patient has a pump problem with a significantly reduced EF, you'd consider dobutamine in conjunction with a cardiology or intensive care specialist. I know it's a lot, but remember, you've trained for this.